Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is February 28, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is SGEM, a classic paper. OPALS, Ontario Pre-Hospital Advanced Life Support Study. And today, back, of course, by popular demand, I have Dr. Anand Swaminathan. And Swami, as he's known to his friends, is an assistant program director at NYU Bellevue Hospital in the Department of Emergency Medicine. His interests are resident education, critical care, and evidence-based medicine. Swami, I know you love debunking urban legends in EM, and of course, you're a strong supporter of the FOMED movement. Welcome back to the SGEM, Swami.
Good to be here, Ken. It's been a little while, but it's nice to be back on the program.
Everything been going well in New York?
I can't complain, except that it is bitterly cold here still.
Remember, you're speaking to a Canadian.
Yeah, you'd probably be pretty happy here. It's like 8 degrees, so that's pretty balmy for you guys.
I'd be running around in a shorts and a t-shirt and swimming in the pool.
Perfect.
So, hey, what do you think of that classy music intro by Masterpiece Theater?
Yeah, that was nice. You know, those of us from, I think from our generation, as soon as you say Masterpiece Theater, that trumpet starts playing in our head. And I haven't been able to get it out of my head since you told me that was going to be the theme for the theme music for the show.
Well, I want to get into people's heads so we can start addressing knowledge translation. And hey, how this whole Masterpiece Theater classic papers of EBM came up is that you contacted me recently and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a classic paper. Now, anyone who, of course, has been listening to the SGEM knows that we're always trying to cut that knowledge translation window down from an average of 10 years down to 1 year. And we do this by putting a critical or skeptical eye on papers published in the last year, with our goal being to provide you, the frontline providers, with the best evidence so you can provide patients with the best care. However, the SGEM has only been podcasting for about 18 months. And there have been some great classic practice-changing papers. So, you've convinced me. I've decided that on occasion, we should try to reach back into the archives of PubMed, dust off some of those old manuscripts, and review a historic paper that we should all be familiar with. Swami, you wanted to start with what paper?
Something not debatable in any way, shape, or form. A little bit of NINS.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, that was 19 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I was like, whoa, you'll be giving Jerry Hoffman and David Newman a stroke. And I thought, well, before we start tackling the most controversial paper in recent memory in emergency medicine, why not start off with something a little easier, something more digestible, a little less contentious? How about addressing ACLS drugs for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest? Hey, we all know that ACLS drugs work really, really well and save lives, right? Right? Do they? Well, Swami, set us up with a case and let's see what we find out today.
All right, great. So you have a 43-year-old man who experiences a cardiac arrest on the street. You're the first provider on scene with EMS, and a cardiac defibrillator is hooked up and the patient's in VFib. He's unsuccessfully shocked, and chest compressions are started. The paramedics ask you, because you're the physician on scene, if you want to intubate, administer medications, or just load the patient in the bus and start transport.
So the question is, does advanced life support techniques, and specifically the drug interventions, improve survival to discharge versus basic life support and rapid defibrillation and CPR in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest? Now, you did a little digging around, Swami, to try to help set this case up with some background on ACLS and out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So can you go through some of that stuff with us?
Absolutely. So, you know, we know sudden cardiac arrest is common. And obviously, Ken, this is about the worst thing that can happen to you. In the U.S., there's about 500,000 cardiac arrests a year. About half of these are out-of-hospital cardiac arrests. And the survival rate's pretty bad. You know, we estimate somewhere around 7 to 10% of patients will walk out of the hospital and have a good outcome. And about 10 to 12 years ago, the American Heart Association built the four-step chain of survival. Now, the first three steps, nobody really debates. Number one is early access to emergency care. And we love that because it puts us right at the forefront of this really bad disease. Step two, early CPR. Step three, early defibrillation. So I don't think that anyone's going to argue with that kind of stuff. And in fact, in communities with high layperson BLS training and AEDs in the community, the rate of survival from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is actually a little higher. You know, Ken, I'm sure you know this. Where's the best place to have a cardiac arrest?
Seattle.
And in a casino in Seattle would be even better. You know, in a casino, they've got cameras on you all the time. They know as soon as you have that arrest, and they'll get you an AED quick. But definitely casinos and airports are the best places to have cardiac arrest if you're going to have one. Now, the fourth step in that chain of survival is a little more controversial, and that's early advanced care. That's basically ACLS-type resuscitation skills, which is a, you know, it's not a single intervention. This includes intubation. It includes multiple IV drug administration as well. Now, ACLS doesn't have a lot of evidence to defend it. And of course, like we said, ACLS is not a single treatment. It's a bundle of treatments. Patients who have out-of-hospital cardiac arrest get ACLS treatment in the field, which may actually delay their transport. So in New York, if somebody has an arrest, they put out a call to EMS, and an ACLS bus is the one that would respond unless there's a BLS bus that's closer to get that patient. Additionally, there's a ton of providers who are trained in ACLS. It costs somewhere between $175 and $250 every 2 years to get certification. And a number of hospitals require ACLS certification in order to practice. So that where I work, I'm not required to carry ACLS certification, but I do moonlight at our Veterans Administration where it is required. So if ACLS isn't proven to help, it brings up really a number of issues. Is it a waste of time and money for providers? Do the therapies in ACLS detract from critical interventions that we know work, like CPR and defibrillation? And now with ECMO becoming a little bit more popular and commonplace in EDs, commonplace may not be the right word, but it's definitely becoming a little bit more of a reality. Is delayed transport a good idea when we can actually offer something different at the hospital? And basically, are we harming patients with ACLS by bringing back more people with significant neurodisabilities? And that's what the authors of this study tried to look into. That's what they wanted to discuss.
Well, before you announce the paper, I want to just point out that people should be familiar with the name, at least the lead author, Dr. Ian Steele. He is arguably one of the most famous cited Canadian EM researchers. And now, if you don't know Dr. Steele by his name, you certainly know his significant contributions to the area of clinical decision instruments. These are the Ottawa Ankle Rules, the Ottawa Knee Rules, the Canadian C-Spine and CT Head Rules, and of course, his latest, the Ottawa Subarachnoid Hemorrhage Rules. We've covered some of these topics on past episodes of the SGEM. Now, I have a little beef with Dr. Steele. Specifically, why did he have to label all of these things rules, Swami? I mean, why not instruments, tools, guidelines? I mean, calling them rules just tempts me to break them. And, of course, it could put people in medical legal jeopardy for not following rules. Ian, if you're listening, and I know you are, would you please consider rebranding all your research? All right, that was my little rant there, Swami. You go ahead. What's the paper?
Yeah, it's a good rant. I agree. Clinical decision instruments makes a lot more sense. So the article we're looking at, again, by Ian Steele et al., Advanced Cardiac Life Support in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. This was in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2004, so just about 10 years ago.
What population were they dealing with, Swami?
So this was a study looking at any patients over 16 years of age who had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and in whom they decided to attempt resuscitation.
And so what intervention were they trying to apply in this research?
So again, they were looking at application of advanced life support program, whereby the paramedics were trained in things like intubation, IV line placement, and IV medication administration.
And what did they compare this intervention to?
So this was compared to basic life support, basically defibrillation and CPR.
And what was their primary outcome?
So primary outcome here was survival to hospital discharge, which was defined as the patient leaving the hospital alive. And they had some secondary measures also. They looked at things like ROSCE, admission to hospital, and the cerebral performance category upon discharge. So how neurologically intact were they?
And you did state that the population was over 16, so I always like to go through the exclusion so we know we're applying it to the correct population. They didn't have anybody under the age of 16. People that were already dead were not included in the study. And these were not trauma arrests. These were cardiac arrests. Any other things that were clearly not cardiac disorders were excluded from this study. Do you want to just give us the author's conclusions and then we'll go through the results?
Absolutely. I'm going to quote right from them.
Perfect.
The results of the OPAL study did not show any incremental benefit of introducing a full advanced life support program to an emergency medical services system of optimized rapid defibrillation.
Whoa. And I'm just going to requote that because I think people need to hear it again. The results of the OPAL study did not show any incremental benefit of introducing a full advanced life support program to an emergency medical service system of optimized rapid defibrillation. Wow.
You gotta love it, Ken. No hedging there. These guys said what they thought.
Yep, they certainly did. Well, let's take a look at their research and see if they can support such a strong conclusion. They had almost 6,000 patients in a study over 4 years, including 17 communities and 11 hospitals. And they had a run-in phase for 12 months that included about 1,400 patients. And that was the rapid defibrillation and CPR stage with no ACLS. For 12 months, they got 1,400 patients looking at just basic life support. And then for the next 36 months, they got just over 4,000 patients. And that's when they did the advanced life support protocols. And do you want to just go through some of the patient characteristics with regards to their cardiac rhythms and medications that they provided, Swami?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Ken, this is a classic before and after. They knew that the advanced life support was rolling out. So they started this study before it did to look at patients. And then after, they looked at how it worked. We look at the initial cardiac rhythm. When you look at the VFib VTAC group, about 35% were in VFib VTAC in the before and 32% in the after, so in the advanced life support phase. PEA, again, 26% versus 25% in the two different windows. And asystole, about the same, 40%, 38.8% versus 42%. So you can see the initial cardiac rhythms were pretty similar between the prior to ACLS group and the with ACLS group. And we look at medications, and this is medications were only in the advanced life support phase, obviously, because in the BLS phase, they didn't use any meds. So about 96% of patients got epinephrine, 87% got atropine, about 24% got lidocaine. And the thing that I thought was really interesting was obviously no patients before got intubated, but intubation attempts were made on almost all of the patients in the after category. So that's also really significant. When we look at the outcomes here, we look at ROSCE. About 13% of patients had ROSCE in the before group and 18% in the advanced life support group. There's an absolute change of about 5%, and that was statistically significant. So more ROSCE after they started with advanced life support.
So what you're saying, Swami, is they saved some lives there. 1 in 20, right? They saved lives.
Well, that's what it would look like on the surface of it, but it kind of depends on what you define as saving a life. Remember, ROSCE was a secondary outcome for them. We haven't gotten to the primary yet.
Yeah, so how many people made it to the front doors or the emergency department alive?
So again, they found a statistical difference here. They found 11% in the before group and about 14.5% in the after group. And that was also an absolute change of 3.7%, statistically significant. So more patients got ROSCE and more patients got to the hospital.
But how about that really important patient-oriented outcome? How many people left the hospital?
So here's where things get a little bit dicey. So survival to hospital discharge, 5% in the before group and 5.1% in the advanced life support group. Absolute change of 0.1%, not statistically significant.
So there was no difference. This is where they got that really strong conclusion. There was no difference to survival to hospital discharge. How about the people that were discharged? Were they neurologically intact? Did they leave the front door? Were they playing the piano if they could play the piano before they arrived?
So nobody came in not being able to play the piano and then left being able to play. That's unfortunate. But what we found was it looked like actually in the before group, there was a little bit of a better outcome in the cerebral performance category, 78% with a category one versus 67% with a category one with advanced life support. But that was not statistically significant. But there was a difference there of about 12%.
And just so people understand, the CPC or cerebral performance categories, there are five of them. And the CPC one is a good cerebral performance that patients are conscious, alert, able to go to work. They might have some mild neurologic deficit or psychological deficit, but not significant. So that's the mild category or CPC one. That was that outcome, right?
That's correct. So no real statistical difference, but does lean towards the pre-treatment group here.
So, and that's the group that didn't have ACLS.
That's correct. So the group that just had early defibrillation and good CPR did a little bit better, but again, not statistically significant.
And then they took a look at these patients 1 year later using a validated tool called the Health Utility Index. And what were the results for patients that did survive to hospital discharge 1 year out?
So again, it leaned towards the group that didn't get advanced life support, but not statistically significant. So about the same at a year.
All right, Swami, this is why we have you here. This is why we do these podcasts, is to put a critical, skeptical eye on the research and on the conclusion and try to understand how could we incorporate this into our knowledge base and practice. And when it comes to a cohort study or a before and after study, there are 12 questions to consider. And so we'll just go through those back and forth, those 12 questions, and see what we come up with. Sound good?
Sounds good to me.
Okay, so the first question, Swami, is did the review ask a clear and concise question, in your opinion?
Absolutely. Very clear and concise. The issue here was whether ACLS management increased patient survival to hospital discharge.
Okay, how about a little bit of a more tricky question? Do you think that this was the appropriate method to answer their question?
You know, I think it's the best that could be done. You know, ideally what we'd like is a randomized control trial. So person arrests, they get randomized to either getting ALS or they just get BLS, but we couldn't really do that. So they did a before and after. They knew that ALS was going to be rolled out. It was going to become the standard of care in their area. So they did a before and after, looking at before they rolled it out, how did they do? And then after, how did they do?
And I think, you know, a randomized control trial, of course, would have been better. And when you think of evidence-based medicine, there is a hierarchy to evidence. And a randomized control trial would be a higher level of evidence than a before and after cohort trial. It's more robust. But like you pointed out, sometimes that's just not feasible. And there are limitations, and you can't do certain studies that involve harm. And so if the standard of care was going to be ACLS, then of course you can't do something that you already a priori I think may cause patients harm.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how about question number three? Was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Yeah, I think so. You know, all out-of-hospital cardiac arrests in Ottawa and catchment area were included for the analysis. So I think that was the appropriate inclusion criteria.
So they captured the net widely and took on consecutive patients. How about the exposure? Was it accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yeah, so the objective measures were used here. The outcomes are ones that both the doctor and patients would care about. In fact, if there was any bias, it was probably in favor of the intervention. Given the fact that there was no difference in the primary outcome, this actually strengthens the conclusion. You know, the bias here would be that we think ALS is better. You can't blind either the provider or the patient to getting ALS or not. So it would lean towards the treatment, but we didn't see that in the results at all.
Yeah, and that sort of leans into question number five about the outcomes being accurately measured to minimize bias. And like you said, it was not possible to blind the patients or the doctors in this kind of before and after study. However, the abstractors who were collecting the data could certainly have been blinded. But, you know, if there was unblinding, it really shouldn't have impacted on mortality data. I mean, people were either alive or dead.
Right. So that's not one of those. The primary outcome here being did they survive to hospital discharge is not one that somebody could fudge based on their biases. It would have been nice if we knew whether the abstractors were blinded or not, and that's not clear from the paper. I think this is sort of a difference between 10 years ago and today where I think it'd be a little clearer for us to figure that out. But we don't know. But again, I agree with you. I don't think it's really that relevant because you're either dead or you're not. You can't be a little dead and you can't be a little pregnant.
Or mostly dead. If you're a, you know, Princess Bride fan.
That's right.
So how about question number 6? Were all important confounding factors identified in this study?
You know, that's hard to say. There's a problem because there's multiple interventions being done, and we referred to that already. This isn't simply whether they're given epi or not. There are other drugs like epi and lidocaine, atropine, maybe amiodarone was in here too. It didn't really look like that was significant. Patients got fluids. They got intubated, and they had time to intubation as well. So all of these things may have worsened the outcome. Any one of these could have been the big issue, and we can't figure that out. It's actually really similar to early goal-directed therapy where we have a bundle of treatments and we're trying to figure out which of those treatments in the bundle are the important ones.
So question number 7, Swami, is was the follow-up complete and long enough?
Absolutely. You know, this was a really easy one to do. Did they survive to hospital discharge or not?
How about question number 8? What were the results? Well, I think we've already done that, and that was there was no benefit to survival to discharge neurologically intact. It was either alive or dead, and the outcome was about 5% for both groups. How about how precise the results were?
Yes, so looking at the confidence intervals here, we're not going to go through all the numbers, but they were pretty tight. They were pretty small, and that's nice to have.
Do you believe the results?
You know, I do, Ken. I'm not surprised by this at all, but I'm not surprised at it in the setting of we've got 10 years of research since this study that corroborates it.
How about question 11? Can you apply these results to your local population?
So that's a great question. You know, I don't live in Canada, but I think the physiology of a Canadian is probably not that different than the physiology of an American. Now, the study was not ED focused. This was in the pre-hospital setting. However, many systems have MDs that are working in the field. We don't do that down here, but that's pretty common in other parts of the world. It'd be important for the individuals to be aware of that when they're looking at this study. Also, we don't work in isolation, but in a continuum of care from pre-hospital, emergency department to inpatient. And these out-of-hospital cardiac arrests are the ones that we really focus on. I don't have a lot of in-hospital cardiac arrests in my emergency department, thankfully. Most of what I'm receiving are the out-of-hospital ones.
And with regards to that ED setting issue, I mean, there's not been any trials that I'm aware of showing the benefit of ACLS medication for in-hospital cardiac arrest. And in addition, there have been some observational studies that suggest ACLS medications could actually cause harm. And I'll refer people, of course, to that excellent website by Newman and the NNT.com. And he's got a nice review up about this very issue. And finally, Swami, question number 12, do the results fit with other available evidence that you're aware of?
Yeah, so again, we've got 10 years of research since this paper showing very similar results. So there was a study out of Norway in 2009. It was a randomized control trial with 850 patients, out of hospital, non-traumatic cardiac arrests. Patients were randomized to get ACLS with or without IV drugs. And like in OPALs, they showed that they improved, they increased the rate of ROSCE and admission to hospital, but no benefit to discharge from the hospital in a neurologically intact state or benefit at a year. And there are multiple other studies looking at the same thing. There's a number of studies that are observational out of Japan looking at the use of epinephrine. So this is sort of a phased across the world. Different EMS systems are getting access to different drugs and they're able to look at these from a registry standpoint. And we see the same thing happen over and over again. You give epinephrine, you get more people that come in with a heartbeat, but not more people that are walking out of the hospital alive. And I would argue, Ken, I agree with Newman on this one. We're not just not doing benefit. We're actually doing harm to these patients by bringing them back from the dead, and they don't have any functional outcome.
So is this going to change what you do then?
Well, this is the tricky question, isn't it? So you talk about cutting the knowledge translation window. This is a study from 10 years ago, and we're just talking about it now. And I'll tell you, this wasn't a study that came up very often during my training. People didn't talk about this. This is sort of the benefit of FOMED and podcasts is that we can cut this down. I imagine that if you had a podcast back in 2004, we would have discussed this and people would know about it back then. So no, it's not going to really change what I do. You know, it's been 10 years. And ACLS is still the standard of care treatment. I'm an ACLS instructor, so I teach other people. I teach 20, 25 people a year to do ACLS. And I often sit there thinking, should we really be teaching them this? And I try to stress the important things, which are good CPR, good defibrillation, and how to actually ventilate somebody with a bag valve mask. But OPALS is one paper in a group that questions the quality of ACLS care and whether we should be readdressing this algorithm. Also, we don't work in a pre-hospital setting. So while they're not going to change what I do, it has sort of come out in the evidence over the last 10 years that the things we should be focused on are good CPR, early defibrillation, and that's where the money is.
Okay, so for the bottom line for this podcast, I've put down addition of advanced life support algorithms to BLS management did not increase the survival to hospital discharge for patients with out-of-hospital arrest. Can you bring it back to the case that you presented with that gentleman who collapsed on the street?
Yeah, so again, we've got this guy who has an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. You're on scene with EMS, and they ask you what you should do now that we've defibrillated and started CPR. And you advise them, let's get him in the ambulance. Let's get him to the hospital. Let's not delay for a placement of an IV or epinephrine. And let's see if we can shock him again and get him back.
Excellent. Well, Swami, that concludes the first ever SGEM Classic Paper Critical Review. I'm interested in what people think about this. Let me know if you think this was a good idea. Should we do more podcasts on historic practice-changing papers like this? If you think that's a good idea, then why not send me your suggestions? Drop me a line at thesgem@gmail.com with classic in the subject line, and we'll consider putting our skeptical lens on the paper you send me. We have a Keener contest winner from last week, and that winner was Dr. Mark McAllister. He knew that PDS sutures take greater than 90 days for complete absorption. And you know what, Swami, I thought that, you know, for a Keener contest, I like history of medicine stuff. And so for this week's Keener contest, I want to know who was the first person to isolate adrenaline or epinephrine. And if you know the answer for that, send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. And if you're the first person to get that answer right, I will send you a cool skeptical prize. And just as a final reminder, there is still a couple of weeks left to sign up for Sweet Beam in Stockholm, Sweden, March 17th and 18th. But if you can't make it to Europe, then consider coming out to Prairie Beam later in the spring in Winnipeg. Swami, great idea. Thanks for suggesting this classic paper. I think people are going to like it. What do you think? Do you think they're going to like it? Do you think they're going to want more?
I think there's a real place for us looking back and looking at these papers, the ones that were really important. And you're right. You know, Ian Steele is a big researcher still. We should know his work.
Well, I always ask our invited guests to give the tagline. Would you be so kind?
Absolutely. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.